At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today?
I think my battery's dead.
With free battery testing and charging, we can help you get back on the road.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
So what if I need a new one?
We have the right Duralast battery for you, only at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
And what about my old battery?
We can recycle it right here at America's number one battery destination.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
Comeback Stories is a production of Inflection Network and iHeartRadio.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are here for another episode of Comeback Stories. I am always here with my guy for life, Darren Waller. How you doing, my man?
I'm blessed, bro. I'm excited for this episode, man.
I'm so excited for this episode. So today's guest, he's the co-founder of Marley's Mutt's Dog Rescue and Positive Change Program. This dude has a story that I absolutely love and I can relate to so much. And when I think about the service work that he's doing, it really makes me realize that I need to step up my game. The work he's doing is incredible. So we're here with Zach Scow. Zach has a story where dogs actually rescued Zach from addiction. Then he took that experience to start Marley's Mutts, taking rescue dogs to help rescue people. And from there, he started Positive Change Program, pairing death row dogs with incarcerated people. So, Zach, welcome to the show, my man.
My man, it is great to see you, my brother. You too, Darren. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, we're always getting right into it here on the show. And we want to know, for you, tell us a little bit what it was like growing up for you.
Let's get vulnerable, Donnie. Life growing up for me was kind of quintessential when I think about it. I grew up, I'm actually down here in Manhattan Beach right now. I grew up in Hermosa Beach, California, in what's called the South Bay, Redondo, Manhattan, Hermosa, Torrance. And it was an incredible place to grow up, you know, an absolutely incredible place to grow up. We were babysat by the beach. You know, we were all latchkey kids. We had this little incubated bubble that is the South Bay, where PCH and the refinery to the north and other kind of barricades created this really incredible place to grow up. Just a very unique place where we surfed and we skated and we got into trouble and had a very drinking heavy, drug heavy culture. That's to be certain. I grew up in a broken home. You know, my parents separated when my twin brother and I were very young. They got divorced right when we got out of the hospital. Both my brother and I were very ill when we were born. So, life started out that way in a broken home, with a lot of different, you know, advantages to that as well. I don't want to just say there were disadvantages. I got to grow up in two beautiful homes. My mom was my primary, and we grew up in a house with another single family, another female led family. And that was how I kind of eased into adulthood, which was that beach culture. You know, I was inundated with beach culture and all that that implies.
When you look back on your childhood, is there an early memory of pain that really stands out to you?
Yeah, there are some definite painful moments that stand out from my childhood. Some of those would manifest and become real issues as I got older. Some of those had to do with, you know, inappropriate contact and conduct as a child, things that I received and went through as a kid in terms of, inappropriate sexual contact and things that I didn't know at the time would affect me like they would in adulthood. I think I was a lot like everybody else, man. I really wanted to fit in. I really wanted to be a part of. And I think some of my earliest memories of, in terms of painful memories, were not feeling a part of, and certainly not feeling as connected to my parents as I wanted to. My parents were both working professionals, so they were gone all the time. You know, and much of my childhood was spent with, you know, with sitters and with caretakers. So I didn't get to spend much time with my mom, didn't get to spend as much time with my dad as I would have wanted to, because they were out hustling, you know, trying to make a living to support us kids. So that's one of the things that I think about now, you know, in adulthood that kind of pained me when I was younger, was just wanting a deeper connection, you know, as a child.
And a deeper connection with specifically your mom, or was it just yearning for something deeper?
Definitely with my mom, for sure. My mom was a professional at ABC. She was an executive, one of the youngest female executives ever at ABC and Disney. So, you know, that time where you, looking back on it, what I really craved when I was younger was just that feeling safe, feeling supported and feeling safe within that family structure. And we were very much children of the streets, very much running amok kind of constantly. And we had, like I said, you know, these were wonderful people that helped raise us. You know, Isabel and Juan and Sadie were and still are family members, but they weren't my parents. And so, as I've got older in life, that's something that I definitely have tried to make up for in adulthood, in terms of kind of recreating that narrative, recreating the relationship, and kind of also just accepting that my parents did their absolute best. We tend to hold our parents to this unreachable standard, and we tend to not view them as just normal people who are doing their best. They were single parents too, just like I am now, and a single dad. And that's a tough life to try to figure out. You got two twin babies. You know, like I said, my brother and I were extremely sick. My brother was at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center for 4 months before he got to come home. So it was a tough time to come into the world and have our family kind of split apart, but they absolutely did their best with what they had. And I'm trying to give them credit, as opposed to just kind of, you know, knock them as I'm in my 40s.
Zach, I appreciate your vulnerability first and foremost, something that we appreciate and try to hold space for on this platform. And the fact that you're leading off with it is amazing. And I know you talked about wanting to feel safe. For me, when I was 15 years old, I think I started to feel safe via Percocets and people pleasing. Where do you feel like you first started to turn towards to start to feel safe or feel some sort of peace?
Yeah, people pleasing is my big one. I always grew up very quickly. So I was a 18-year-old when I was 10. I was always running around with parents. I grew up in a household that had a lot of other kids that I sort of had to keep an eye out. My twin brother included. He kind of, just how we were raised, he was sort of my little brother. So I was doing a tremendous amount of parenting and trying to just keep the vibe tolerable. I was trying to like put out fires and not create chaos, not feed into the chaos that is a single mother household with all the comings and goings. And yeah, I started to medicate very early on, like 10 years old, 11 years old is when I remember first getting into my mom's wine. And a lot of that was just related to wanting to be an adult, was just seeing what all the adults did every single night and wanting to be considered an adult, wanting to be a grown up and wanting to do the things that the people I admired did. But that, you know, I think throughout my entire life, if I'm being honest, I always felt different. I always felt a level of anxiety, maybe like a simmering level of anxiety, might not even be the right word, but just uneasiness. I've always felt a little bit uneasy. And when I found alcohol and drugs, I found acceptance of myself. I found being accepted by others. You know, I found it gave me a lot of the things that I thought you needed to be a successful person, right? I was funnier. I was more affable. I could kind of fall. I could slide into that role and portray myself as older than I was. I thought that was one of the ways you grew up, was by learning how to drink. And I took that very seriously. All my heroes were, you know, I don't want to say functioning alcoholics. They were just alcoholics. And I set my sights early on to try to integrate that into my life. I knew drinking was important. I mean, it was prioritized in terms of my social circles and my culture. That was something that it helped if you were really good at. And, I started to bury a whole lot of discomfort, uneasiness, anxiety, I also had this, you know, they called me Golden Boy when I was a kid. That was the moniker I had. It was everybody had this idea of me that I was this golden child, that I was this handsome kid that could do really well in school. And I played every sport very well. So I was good at everything. And I peaked when I was like 12. So as soon as I started to not meet those expectations and I started to do less good in school, I started to get into fights, I started to do whatever, you know, it really facilitated a spiral because I couldn't meet up to those expectations. And I think a lot of us fight meeting expectations of ourselves at a young age and then never really being able to catch up with and accept who we actually are and love that person. You know, I've always thought people loved the idea of me and the expectation of me as opposed to who I actually am. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, man, I know too much of what you're saying. I felt that way 3 years into the NFL with every goal, every dream on my list checked off as far as what would be the blueprint to happiness and success. And I just like, this ain't it. Because from when I was a kid, you know, I wasn't black enough around the kids I was growing up around. And I had no identity in that. But I found identity in how many pills I could pop or how many beers I could drink. And it's like that,
for sure,
that, you know, that identity around alcohol is real because nothing ever made me feel good. But when you told me I could outdrink people, that made me feel great. And
I started to get that credibility as a social facilitator,
right?
Too, you get that credibility for how much you can drink, how much you can use. Do you got the hookups? Do you know all the different kids that have the different various hookups so that you can facilitate party time? Do you know all the different phone numbers to call? And I became that party facilitator, that social coordinator early on. And that's another way that I got a lot of my like worth and my value is like facilitating a good time.
No doubt.
Yeah.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit Bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep experts. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus 2 free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
How long did it go on for? So you started drinking, you're experimenting at 10 or 11. Where did that end up? Like, what was, I mean, walk us through a little bit of the path and the progression of the drinking and what else it led to and ultimately to your lowest point.
Well, I think culturally, I was always striving towards some level of alcoholism. That sounds strange, but where I come from, you know, you are kind of, your adolescence and your early adulthood, are spent kind of like honing your social capability, which means how you drink, how you use drugs, et cetera. So I got into daily drinking, you know, drinking as often as I could, really, when I was 15, 16, always drinking at parties, drinking every weekend. That progressed into, you know, weed and cocaine and other things, nitrous oxide, acid, mushrooms, things like that at a young age, all through high school. And then by the time I went off to college at San Diego State University, I was, I drank as often as you could put it in front of me. So any excuse to consume alcohol or drugs, I would gravitate towards and pursue. And that quickly, I became enslaved to alcohol by the time I was 18. I knew I was an alcoholic. I used to listen to the Alcoholics, the rat group. That was like we would party to the Alcoholics, and all they do is sing anthems about, you know, grotesque consumption of alcohol and just overt alcoholism. And those were our theme songs. You know, I really pursued that level of oblivion as often as I could because I needed it internally and because it was a status symbol. Like, that was acceptance where I was running. And, you know, your access to drugs and alcohol, your ability to consume, to be the life of the party was how you found acceptance. So I felt like I really needed those things in order to be participating in society and to gain any acceptance. But I made a decision really early on. I knew I was an alcoholic, and I knew I was physically addicted too, because I went like one weekend, tried not to drink when I was in college. And I thought, all right, I'm just going to commit myself, just like my parents do, to drinking every night. That's what everybody else does. I can make the adjustment. I'll figure out how to drink, you know, even to oblivion on the regular, and we'll just figure it out. We'll be okay. And that gave way to selling weed at first, to trying to, you know, support my habits. I didn't have any money. And, you know, I've not had any money up until recently, to be honest, in terms of saving, because, you know, a lot of my life is spent giving back. But yeah, my relationship with alcohol and drugs completely overtook my life very early on, and it totally occupied my transom, my sun up to sundown until I got sober. I mean, I was completely enveloped by the devils of addiction in every way, shape, and form. Every place that leads you, everything that it does to you physically, emotionally, relationship-wise, it completely took over my life, and it took my body completely failing in order for me to have the realization I needed to. I tried, man. I tried to go to meetings. I tried to link up with people. I tried to go cold turkey. I tried everything to eliminate alcohol and drugs from my life, or to drink like a gentleman, or to do this, that, and the other. And it just wasn't possible for me. I needed that absolute rock bottom in order to facilitate any kind of recovery.
So what were the physical ramifications of that much drinking for you?
Well, it was interesting. You know, I was drinking 24 hours a day. I got in a car accident in 2003. I broke my chest and my shoulder. I broke my sternum and my shoulder.
God.
And, you know, I got knocked out, and I was driving intoxicated. I rolled my truck off a cliff and rolled down the cliff and got knocked out and hurt myself severely. And that, you know, that experience, just healing from that experience, I had to drink to get through that. I had to drink a lot to get through that. I mean, I was drinking a box of wine a day just to get through the physical pain of healing from that injury. And that's what initiated 24 hours a day drinking. That was like, there's this fine edge when you commit yourself to alcohol and to alcoholism, and just the danger of doing that dance, where it can push you over into 24 hours a day to that physical dependency, not just emotional, but true physical dependency. And after I healed from that injury, I tried to go cold turkey, and the physical, emotional, that kind of withdrawal was brutal. And I, again, before I got really sick, I committed myself to alcoholism. I had another conversation with myself after that crash. And I said, all right, well, I guess I'm addicted to alcohol, and I guess we're just going to have to figure out how to live addicted to alcohol, as opposed to trying to pull the ripcord and ask for help, figure out a way. It was just too daunting. Trying to come up against society's norms, how well woven alcohol and alcoholism is to our social fabric, was just overwhelming to me. I couldn't contemplate fitting into my skin, fitting into society, fitting into my family as a sober individual. Nope. And underneath it all, I think the main part was I couldn't tolerate myself.
True.
You know, when those voices would creep in, as soon as alcohol and drugs would seep out of my system and those voices would start to creep in, it was a overwhelming panic that would take over my body. If I got to run away from myself, I can't tolerate you. I just cannot tolerate you, dude. And the only way I could get myself out of my head is through alcohol. So it just facilitated this brutal, brutal cycle until my liver finally failed. You know, I went into full blown alcoholic liver failure, and I tried with all of my power to avoid getting that diagnosis, and to the point where I just wouldn't go to the doctor. I mean, I was leaking blood from both ends of my body. And by the time I finally went to the doctor and got, you know, blood tests and checked up on, I'll never forget it. The nurse came out and sat down next to me. She put her hands on my hands and she said, honey, you know, these are your blood test results and you're in liver failure and you need to go to a hospital right now. And I was at a hospital, but not a very good one. And she said, you know, this is very serious. And I said, okay. And I just completely brushed it off. I went home. I lied to my dad. I started wearing baggy. I was turning yellow. So I started to turn bright yellow. My belly started to fill up with blood and bile. So I was like 9 months pregnant. I had these varicose veins feeding this huge mass inside of my stomach. My belly button was herniated. My ankles were full of liquid. My feet were full of liquid. And I couldn't come to grips with that diagnosis because I knew it meant no more alcohol for me forever. So I just avoided it. I just lied and avoided it. And then finally, I started to have ammonia build up on my brain where you forget where you are. You lose your balance. You don't understand who you are. Sometimes you kind of vacillate between coherence and total incoherence. And it was at that point that my dad took me to the hospital, to Bakersfield Memorial Hospital for long-term stay. And I stayed there for almost 6 weeks. The first thing the doctor said after they got me stabilized was, you know, your son needs a liver transplant and he's not going to get one, period. I was given, you know, an 80% chance of dying within 90 days if I didn't have a liver transplant. So it was very cut and dry. It was, you need a liver transplant immediately or you're going to die. And they don't give alcoholics liver transplants, period. You need 6 months of recovery just to apply, just to be considered for the transplant program. And I didn't have 6 hours of sobriety. You know, it was a terribly dire situation, you know?
So do you end up getting the transplant or what happens next?
So there's only 7 hospitals in the state of California that do liver transplant. And I was not at one of them. And I was not in a transplant program. So there was no chance and no hope of me getting a liver transplant. The only hope was to get into one of those hospitals. And my dad is in there. This is so much of my sobriety story, so much of my comeback story is really a love story between a dad and his son. You know, a dad who just refused to give up on his son, refused to say, this is our lot in life. You know, he's not going to make it. And we just have to accept that. It never entered his mind for a second that I wasn't going to make it. And he did everything in his power to get me to a hospital that would care for me. And we finally got a meeting through a nurse who worked for our insurance company. And she got us a very chance interview with the Cedars-Sinai Comprehensive Transplant Center. So that's the best transplant center in America. It's at the hospital I was born at. And they said, if you can get here within the next 2 days, we will get you a meeting with Dr. Tram Tran, who's the head of transplant. So my dad said, we're going, you know, pull all this shit out of your body. We're going. And the doctor said, no, you're not. You can't leave here. He'll die if you leave here. I mean, I was the sick person could get. You know, I'd gone through alcohol withdrawal in the hospital. I got addicted to Dilaudid in the hospital. That's a whole nother story. I got heavily addicted to opiates that 6 weeks that I was in the hospital. So I was in a very delicate state to be moved, period. But my dad did it, and he signed me out against doctor's orders. We did a burnout in the parking lot to get as far away from that place as humanly possible because I was dying in there. They were not doing anything to help me. I was simply dying and making life a living hell for the nurses that were there because I needed dope, you know, every 4 hours. And we got that meeting with the Comprehensive Transplant Center. Dr. Tram Tran sat me down and went over all my information. And she said, look, if we check you into this hospital, you're going to die here. And this is very touch and go, but we're going to send you home. You've been admitted to the Comprehensive Transplant Program. It's emotional. If you can get 6 months sober, we will get you a liver transplant. But you have to get you have to survive 6 months. And, you know, the numbers said I wasn't going to make it 90 days, much less 6 months. So there wasn't a lot of hope, you know, and they sent us home. And they said, look, he's going to have to kick dope. So stay near an emergency room. You're going to need it. And you're on your own. You're going to have to check in with us, you know, every 24 hours. And they sent me home. And my dad's thinking to himself, you know, you just released him to the care of our dogs. And instead of a medical facility, you want our dogs and me to take care of a drug addicted, recovering alcoholic with zero sobriety who needs a liver transplant. And my dad's like, you got to be kidding me. What am I going to do with this kid? You know, and as I'm sure that both of you can imagine, I convinced him to take me to the hospital for shots. You know, that was how we spent the first 2 weeks, was me trying to go through opiate withdrawal, but too chicken shit to kiss the dragon on the nose and struggling through every second of it. You know, I mean, you know how it is. Your central preoccupation, you can't help but have your central preoccupation be drugs when you're addicted to drugs. Nothing else can really enter. Nothing else can permeate that boundary layer. And that was my focus. And so long story short, we finally got through that. We got through that opiate withdrawal. That was the first big miracle. My dogs helped me get through. You know, I had three rescue dogs that I gotten from the Mojave Animal, well, that I gotten through from our community, a couple of them from the Mojave Animal Shelter. And kicking the lotted, going through opiate withdrawal with those dogs helped me to a tremendous degree, because that was one of the scariest things I've ever been through. That was like 2 days of hallucinations and not being able to trust what I was hearing, seeing, you know, a full body fear too, like a full spiritual fear that like the likes of which you can't imagine. And I just remember going through that and rooting down in my dog, feeling my big Rottweiler pit bull Marley, and just touching him to try to get through it and try to remind me what was real and what was not real. You know what I mean? That was the first big miracle that helped kind of facilitate my life, was getting off dope.
Man, that's... Wow.
And obviously there's a lot more to this story. It keeps kicking on as the recovery happened. So after I got home, we were able to get through the opiate withdrawal process. And after I got through that, you know, I had soiled myself in the bed. I couldn't control my bowels. I was on a whole lot of very intense medication, and how they keep ammonia buildup off your brain when you're in liver failure is through this medication called Enula. So I had gone to the bathroom in bed, which happened regularly. And rather than wake my dad up, I went into the bathroom to clean myself off. And I'll never forget walking past the mirror and looking at myself and seeing this like hollowed out human being that I did not recognize at all. I was completely naked, you know, because I had to take all my clothes off to clean myself up. And I was totally yellow, and every part of my body was purple, was bruised from needles going in and from bumping into things. You bruise really easily when you're in liver failure. I didn't recognize my eyes. I didn't recognize who was looking back at me, quite literally. You know, I looked much, much older, and I looked like a person I didn't recognize. And I just started to cry, like just that this is the end cry, that like soul crushing, defeated sob of, I can't believe this is what I've done to myself. You know, I cannot believe I've done this to myself. And I mean, the way I looked, man, I'll never forget it. The veins in my stomach were the most intimidating, and you could see them on my throat too. And I look over at my dogs in this like terrible moment of just self-loathing and pity. And all my dogs are looking up at me next to the toilet, because I'd always like sit around the toilet. And they're looking up at me like I'm the world's greatest human being. Sure. Like they see all of the nuke, everything innate to me, the love, the compassion, the empathy, the potential, like all the human potential that was still locked inside of me, and all the things that were good about me that I did know were in there. They latched onto, like they looked at me with all that adoration and that love and that, and maybe even a little bit of sympathy, but like this attitude of, we're good. You're good. You're good right now. You're good. And I didn't see any of that, man. I saw this is time to let it go. Like, this is time to pull the plug. And they saw it. You're good. You know, you're all right. And I'll never forget looking at them and thinking, first of all, what's going to happen to my dogs if something happens to me? And two, you know, just feeling what they were giving me, feeling the emotions that they were sending me, this ultimate accept, unconditional love. For us in recovery, unconditional love is the North Star. You know, it's something we're always striving towards, is that unconditional love. And our dogs give us that medicine in a form that is so digestible and so relatable and so warm and so imperturbed by other variables or other qualifications. It's just there, it's raw, it's real. And if you let it in, it will help you rebuild yourself, you know? So just that little bit of confidence they gave me in that thing, they knew everything could be okay and that it would be okay. and that kind of facilitated the first day of the rest of our life. Just that experience with my dogs at that really low moment catalyzed me to say, all right, we're going to give it a shot, man. We're going to try to figure this out. And then we're going to try to put one foot in front of the other, just literally. And that morning, I didn't go back to sleep. I took a picture of the sunrise. I journaled in my journal. And I remember thinking to myself on that first journal entry, you guys will love this. I remember thinking on that first journal entry, I'm probably still going to die. And they're going to find this journal and they're going to be like, Jesus Christ, this guy can't spell for shit. And his handwriting is terrible. Like, that's what I was thinking, is that when I die, and this will be the only record of my last few months, and people are going to make fun of me. Instead of, you know, that's just how sick we are in the mind and how self-absorbed and, you know, we can be. But that really did. It kicked off the first day of the rest of our life. And every day for years after that, several times a day, we just went for a walk. So every morning was walking in the mountains with those dogs, trying to put one foot in front of the other towards wellness and whatever happened on the road. Right. And, through just that simple process of focusing on those rescue dogs and that walk, it started to give me one, it was very important, was a concept of divinity in a relationship with God. I started to recognize my surroundings. I started to see God in my dogs. I started to feel God in myself. I started to see it in the mountains and in the people I interacted with. It was all around me. It was all around me, this loving, this unconditional loving energy that I always pushed away as an atheist was around me everywhere. And another really cool thing about recovery is that you get to create and adapt and your own idea of what God means to you. That was what was so uplifting and fulfilling and exciting to me, and even creative about recovery, is that you get to come up with and manifest a God of your understanding. No one else's. It's mine. It's my understanding. You don't have to ascribe to it. But you know, my God gets to consist of a whole lot of ideas, essences that aren't associated with conventional religion and dogma, you know. And I really, really appreciated that about recovery. But just that process of working with my dogs led to more working with dogs, led to bringing in foster dogs into my pack. I'd been working with the Humane Society, a couple of local organizations before I got sick. I started to volunteer with them again. I started to totally dedicate my life to these animals. So while I'm in recovery, it's very interesting what dogs need in rehabilitation is exactly what people need in recovery. Dogs need exercise, discipline, affection, rules, boundaries, limitations, right? Those are the parameters we need to set up for a dog's rehabilitation. A human being likewise needs all of those same things in order to reestablish and reboot their life and refocus it on healthy living and sobriety and the principles of the program. And so that, it just started to naturally happen. As I rehabilitated, the dog started to rehabilitate. And I also got to get creative for the first time, which is really neat. I got to write their stories. I got to take their pictures. So all of a sudden I got this purpose. All of a sudden, all my purpose has been hoarding alcohol and drugs and ingesting it as much as possible. It's been my central preoccupation for as long as I can imagine. Drugs and alcohol were my God. They were my everything, right? They were my purpose. They were my reason to wake up in the morning. They were central to every part of my existence. And that got replaced by dogs. That got replaced by rehabilitating dogs and rescue work. And holy shit, was that transformative, you know, because you'll never recover unless you find a purpose. You can't, recovery is so fickle unless you have something to hang your hat on, unless you have a purpose to plug yourself into. And then it becomes different. You know, it really becomes different once you've found service.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Tired of restless nights? Meet Lisa, the sleep expert. Here at Lisa, we know that good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. That's why their mattresses are made for exceptional comfort and support, catering to every sleep need. Check out Lisa's Sapira Hybrid Mattress, named Best Hybrid Mattress 5 years running. Sleep hot? The Chill Collection is built with cool-to-the-touch top fabric and layers of high-density comfort foams, all intended to remove excess body heat while maximizing comfort. With Lisa, getting a new mattress has never been easier. Delivery is free, and you have 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. Don't spend another night dreaming of better sleep. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to lisa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. That's leesa.com/iHeart. Exclusions apply. See lisa.com for more details.
Darren, I gotta say, man, I'm loving how you've really made yourself at home in the big city. I'm curious, how are you getting around? You a subway guy, cab, Uber?
I'm glad you asked, Donnie, man. I got the honor to partner with All American Ford over in New Jersey. They've been taking really good care of me since I got out here. And that's what I love most about them, man. They treat me like I'm family, not just a customer trying to get a deal or just a statistic. You know, they give me great service. You can tell they got a commitment to quality. The innovation is unmatched. And just so if anybody's, you know, like me trying to get around in New Jersey, don't know where to go, I'm telling you, go check out All American Ford here in Jersey. They're going to take real good care of you.
When we come back, you'll hear more of this inspiring comeback story.
Wow, man. I can't, you know, get the image of when you were talking about the dogs looking at you as you were like in the bathroom and seeing the good in you. What was, you know, as you started to go on the walks and you started to find purpose and you started to, things started to change, like what was some of that good that you started to see in yourself that was always there that just had to kind of be, you know, dug up?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really interesting. So what happened was, you know, all along I've been trying to get 6 months of sobriety just to get this liver transplant. But I'm now out and about in my community. I was very terrified to get out into public. I couldn't have done it on my own, but I had my dogs with me. So I start venturing out into public. I start putting up all these adoption posters for advertisement all over town. So people start to notice this yellow, thick guy with a black pit bull that is schlepping all over town, talking to everybody. And I looked very significant. I looked very ill. So people took a big notice of me. And I started to see the positive, you know, I started to feel myself move through the world with a positive frequency, with an energy and a vibe that people were receptive to. I never had a sober, no one moved towards me,
right,
like receptive to my positive energy when I was drinking, or maybe they did if they were drinking and I was drinking, we were using drugs together, but people on the streets never felt my positivity. People on the streets didn't absorb the positive streak I was trying to leave back. So what animals did for me is help me leave a positive streak wherever I went. Wherever I went, I left a positive streak. And the people that walked through that streak, they could pick up that energy and take it with them wherever they went. So I started to notice this concrete, this wonderful interaction that we'd have with virtually everybody we came in contact with, because I would always have at least one dog with me, and that would facilitate if anything, I was, in the early days, I was very, very concerned being in public. It was very hard for me. I had tremendous social anxiety. And so to not only get used to that and address that social anxiety, but to push through it and recognize yourself as an asset, as a societal asset, and start thinking about of yourself as having this really wonderful frequency to share with the world. I started to get excited to leave. I started to get excited to go out in public. And that was, considering how I looked, that would have been unthinkable. But I was in my sobriety, in this new vibe I was able to inherit. Had the ability to positively affect anybody I came in contact with. And that was just critically important. And that really gave me this, like, catalyzed me to keep going and to just keep trying to figure out who this new person is. Who is this person of service, Zach Scout? You know, who is this? Am I a dog rescuer? I got to find several things that presented themselves as places to put my energy. You know, animal rescue being one, and then people rescue being another. So by the time I finally got 6 months of sobriety, by the time I finally qualified for a liver transplant, I no longer needed a liver transplant. See. All of this walking in the mountains every single day, all of this work, by throwing myself into the work I was doing, I was able to really change everything about my life. I changed when I put my body, everything I ate, everything I put in my body, I changed all of my habits. And before you know it, through this process of rehabilitating my dogs, of just walking these dogs in the mountains and trying to get them adoptable, trying to teach them rules, boundary, structure, exercise, all those things, I had taught myself. And so I'm rehabilitating these rescue dogs while rehabilitating myself. And my body, the resiliency of the body is remarkable. I was 28 years old when I got sick. I was 29 when I got out of the hospital. And my body bounced back to a degree which is incredibly surprising and really miraculous. By the time I got my 6 months sober and qualified for that transplant, I no longer needed one. Now I'm still enrolled in the comprehensive transplant program. You're a patient for life. Once you are end stage, and when you're in liver failure, it's not even called like stage 4 or 5. They call it END, end stage liver disease, because you get a liver transplant or you die. Those are your outcomes. So for my outcome, for my liver to have actually healed itself and regressed from stage 4 cirrhosis was completely miraculous. I'll never forget that meeting at 6 months where Tran said, my doctor said, look, man, I don't know what you're doing up there in the mountains, but keep doing it. You know, you need to keep doing it, because there's a chance your body will be resilient enough for you to continue and not need a liver transplant. So here we are now, 14 years later, almost 15 years later after I got out of the hospital, and I still have my same liver. I've actually regressed to what's called stage 3 fibrosis. So I don't even have cirrhosis anymore, which is, again, it's completely miraculous. Part of a couple of studies at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center for those who have come back from end stage failure without a liver transplant. So I'm involved in trying to, you know, help give some insight and some guidance to those who are suffering with this disease and need some hope, and hopefully they'll come up with some answers within that program. But yeah, it's even just talking to you guys about it this far on, it's really remarkable to recount. It almost feels like it happened to somebody else.
As I heard you explain, I could hear and feel the emotion come up when you were talking about your dad, and I couldn't help but get emotional also just thinking about my dad and how he would do anything. Like, you know, it's almost like it was part of his purpose, where he would really felt like he was in his purpose trying to help me, you know, do anything he could to get me out of this disease. And so that was a big piece I wanted to circle back to. And then also that, you know, I remember my rock bottom. I mean, the image that I have of myself lying on a couch in Cincinnati, Ohio, completely isolated, not wanting to be around anybody, nobody wanting to be around me. And my dog would come up she was a rescue boxer named Roxy. And she would come up with a ball in her mouth, and I couldn't even get off my couch, and she would sit there and nudge me with the ball and then eventually give up. I can remember her licking the tears off of my face, and I couldn't even step foot outside to go throw the ball with her. And that unconditional love, and she lived till about 13. She passed away about 5 years ago. But super emotional for me, because she saw both sides of me. And that unconditional love, man, I mean, we can learn a lot from our dogs, as you're explaining. I'd like to know now, like, how do you get into working with incarcerated people?
Yeah, so the way we got into creating the positive change program was, I had a dog that I was fostering that had been shot as a pit bull mix. And we paired that with a gentleman who had just been released from prison. He had been incarcerated since he was 17 for 13 years. And we paired him with that dog, and it fundamentally changed the entire trajectory of his life. He was kind of a lot of people when they get released from prison are somewhat feral to the cultural standards that we kind of abide by. They have been living in a very different system for a very long time. So trying to, for him to reenter society was very challenging. But once we got him that dog, for the same reasons that it is for us in recovery, right? You're nervous about getting out into the world. You're nervous, you know, you're going to be sizing up a dude or feeling like you're being sized up. He's going to not understand how to interact potentially with people of the opposite sex who he hasn't really interacted with properly in decades, right? So there's all these things that make it difficult to assimilate. And we adopted him, that dog, and it just changed everything. He started to give his testimonial with me. He started to share at the mission at Kern County where my mom was getting sober at the time. And he became one of our employees. He then got hired to work as a shelter manager for another organization out of Oklahoma. So this just this simple dog adoption with this individual created this positive trajectory that is still beneficial today. He has his own dog rescue organization up in Lake Isabella, and it's called Strength of Shadow, and it's a big deal, you know? And so that I saw, I had a kind of an aha moment there, and I started researching dog programs. And I found out how incredibly difficult it is to get in the prison system. So spent 4 years trying to find a way in, just trying to shoehorn my way in, write emails, and nobody was having it until finally January of 2016, Warden David Long at California City Correctional Facility took a chance on us, and he piloted our program at their prison. And the rest is sort of history. We started off that program somewhat slow, and then we quickly went to 30 students, 10 dogs at a time. So it's a 14-week-long program, three months of which the dogs, these are dogs straight from the shelter, almost all euthanasia list young, large dogs. So young, large dogs are the most euthanized. They have the smallest chance of being adopted because they're adoption liabilities. They don't have the skills to be adopted, right? So we rehabilitate those dogs in that prison setup. They work on their canine good citizen certification, and with that certification, they graduate, and then they can enroll again in that program. So positive change really took the blessing and the acceptance of a warden who was down and an administrative staff who was down as well. And then truly our staff, the trainers that we had running that program. Positive change is all about the trainers, the people that give of themselves in the institution and share dog psychology and all the things that we've learned over the last 15 years. And the program has just been, it's been magical. I mean, it has been my life's work, to say the least. Like, I feel so lucky to be involved in positive change work, to get to go into prisons all over the state of California, juvenile facilities, female federal prisons, and really do the Lord's work, like do God's work. We're now in 6 facilities. We have 3 men's state prison programs. We have a women's federal prison program, and we have 2 juvenile programs, both a boys and a girls, one in Los Angeles at Camp Kilpatrick, which is actually taught by 2 of our formerly incarcerated trainers. And in the 7.5, almost 8 years we've been going, we've graduated more than 1,000 students, and I think it's 600 plus dogs. So a tremendous amount of lives have been saved. And with that program, we've been able to facilitate professional careers for 26 formerly incarcerated dog trainers. So we now have 26 of our former students, many of whom, if not most of whom, are, you know, black and brown former gang members who have now entered the pet industry, which is a $100 billion recession-proof industry, to have tremendous opportunity as kennel technicians, trainers, behaviorists, pet walkers, daycare facilitators. There is so much opportunity within this industry, and it just fills me up with a tremendous amount of joy and pride to be able to showcase the potential that our students have to make a difference in the world. And to know that several dozen of our dudes are out there making it work and making a difference and contributing to not only our society and culture, but their own more particular societies and cultures where they come from is just the best thing in the world.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Leesa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary. Indulges your senses and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Leesa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Leesa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Leesa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit leesa.com/iHeart. That's leesa.com/iHeart.
Man, I think you're painting an incredible picture of a blueprint for purpose for so many people, especially people that are listening, because you, as young Zach, as you described earlier, just trying to feel safe, trying to figure out what life was all about through like consuming like drugs and alcohol, consuming everything, when really all it took was finding something to contribute to, finding something to give to the world is what ultimately filled you up. And how ass backwards our world and our culture has those things as far as what life really means, man. And I just think it's amazing. And I want to know now, like, now that you have such an incredible purpose in your life, like, how do you balance that with still taking care of yourself and not allowing that area of your life to maybe slack or drift?
Yeah, that's a good one, man. It's very the self-care element of service is tough, right? Because that tends to happen.
Yep.
We go from throttled, just pegged in addiction and alcoholism or whatever else, to then throttling ourselves in service,
right?
You know, and before you know it, you've aged yourself 20 years and 3 years and all the rest of it because you're going at an unsustainable rate. That's a very good question. And I don't know that I do the greatest job balancing my self-care with, you know, all that I have happening around me. I will tell you that one of the variables I use for self-care in my life is literally sitting next to you, connecting myself with people like Donnie and communities like Donnie has created, with like-minded people that you feel accepted by without any effort, has done a world for me. Just having that group of people that you feel radical acceptance with is so, so important in terms of my spiritual wellness, in terms of feeling okay with me. My recovery community, you know, the Donnie's community and other, you know, and even my prison graduate community, the thing that works best for me in terms of my mental health is staying close to those people, staying close to people that know, love me and appreciate me for the right reasons, who have no ulterior motives and who can always remind me of the worth that I have, you know, if I need it. Cause I have that lingering worthlessness that is just always like always beneath the surface, just waiting to breach, you know, with vengeance.
Thanks.
And I think the other thing is are kind of the basic, man, the things that we all know what we have to do to keep ourselves well. We really do. It doesn't take reading the Daily Stoic or going through 17 different, you know, Instagram posts to understand how to take care of yourself. For me, it's about prayer, meditation, and exercise. If I'm doing those things, if I'm meditating and praying and exercising daily, I'm okay. You know, I'm okay. And then obviously I have a whole new component with my kids. That's a big one. For me, rooting into my kids, man, the best thing I can do for self, the best thing I can do for me and the people around me is to root into my kids, because every second of time I spend with them is money in the bank. And because it constantly reminds me to be childlike. It constantly reminds me to have wonder and to be awe-inspired and to be buffoonical, like to just be a dipshit sometimes, to just like have a carefree attitude and to be playful. You know, we forget how to be playful, man. So I would say one of the best things for my spiritual state and my spiritual sort of easiness is really rooting into my kids and not just taking care of them or setting guy or this, that, or the other, but really getting involved in how they live. You know what I mean?
No doubt.
I'll never forget the story you told me about a prisoner who hadn't seen a dog in 42 years. And I'm just curious, and you can tell the story or maybe just share, like, what do you see? What are you observing? What are you getting to witness in those moments when, because, you know, I wouldn't even think about that. And to be able to witness, you know, a human being that has been locked away since they were a teenager for a dumb decision that they made when they didn't know better, hasn't seen a dog. What do you get to see?
Wow. It's what I get to see when I bring dogs into prison is one of the greatest instantaneous transformations you can view. I get to see hardened, incarcerated individuals who've been locked behind concrete walls for decades. I get to see them return to being unconditionally loved children. And that is so powerful to get to witness, because you walk in on that yard, and oftentimes I come to our program on an off day. So I'm just coming on with a couple of dogs, my two personal dogs, to go check in on everybody. So I'll come in on a Friday when we don't have program just to be like, what up, everybody, you know, surprise them. And I'll always walk around the yard. I'll always take my time and walk around the yard and go to other housing units where they don't have programs, just so that guys can come mess with the dogs. And what happens when you see these individuals, that individual in particular, he had just gotten moved. So this gentleman had just gotten moved to C yard at Tehachapi, and he'd been incarcerated for 42 years or 45 years. He hadn't seen a dog in 42 years. And to watch this stone cold expression on his face and he had facial tattoos, everything about him was stay back. Everything about him was fear me, stay back, stay away from me. And I'm definitely not going to let you in. And then as soon as you greet them, I always greet them with hugs. I always shake hand and hug. It's not really with prison policy, but for me, my job in there is to love them. My job is to go in there with bright energy, with that positive streak, just trailing behind me, and be as positive as I can. And when I walk up to an inmate who hasn't seen a dog in decades, and they get down on a knee with Beto or with Cora, they change instantaneously. They go from an individual in tremendous, unfathomable pain and hopelessness to a child who feels unconditionally loved. And you see this just ear to ear grin come on their face. And they'll oftentimes be guys of different races, you know, rival prison gangs who are petting these dogs all together, kind of looking at each other, noticing one another, going, eh, whatever, well, let's just keep going. And so it really brings everybody together in the most magical ways. And I think it helps these guys feel loved, helps them feel accepted, and helps them plug into like a hope and a childishness, a positive childishness that they haven't felt, you know, a kid-like way about them that they haven't plugged into in a very long time, you know? Because everything about being a kid is potential. When you're a kid, everything is possible. Everything is possible, you know? And the other thing that happens when you bring dogs into prison is they feel one step closer to home. Nothing in that place feels like home. Nothing there feels like home. But when you bring dogs in, they all have this idea of, oh, shit, we're a little closer to home. This is a really good sign. We're doing good. We're one step closer to home. And I think prison is about rehabilitation. It shouldn't be about, we know the punitive model doesn't work. This is scientific. We don't need to have long drawn out conversations about this. The punitive model of incarceration doesn't work. And locking human beings in inorganic concrete cells and incubating them in a culture of negativity for decades, and then spitting them out the other end and just throwing them into society to then reoffend and end up back in prison is an absolutely terrible, illogical system. What we need to be doing is infiltrating those those prisons with positive energy. Those programs, that positive energy has to come from without. It does not come from within the prison system. They don't have their own indigenous prison programs. NGOs, nonprofit organizations have to develop these mechanisms and then bring them into the, usually at great cost to themselves, and bring them into the prison system. And when we do, you know, because you can't rehabilitate until you get a person to a state. Rehabilitation doesn't start until they start to love themselves, have some sort of acceptance for themselves. It's very hard to fight against someone when they're dealing with rampant fear and a bunch of things that they're fundamentally hung up on. But when you inject dogs into the system, when you inject canine rehabilitation into their day-to-day, it kind of puts you on this track of wellness, of improving yourself. You're also of service. So every day at 6 o'clock when those cells pop, you got to go get your ass up, go to that crate, let that dog out, go evacuate, feed him, get him into the kennel, get him walked before you go to chow. And then you have to work with your teammate on how that dog's going to be enriched for 14 hours that day while the humdrum of the prison is going on all around you. So there's a, you know, with programs like Positive Change and by infusing a certain level of acceptance and love and hope into the that kind of a system, then real change starts to happen because guys start to think there's a way up and there's a way out. And one of the reasons why I see the prison system fail to the degree that it does is because there is no hope. And when you have that many dudes, you have that many LWOPs, you know, that many life without parole individuals, it brings the entire frequency of that place to hopeless. And you have to inject hope in order to be successful and facilitate rehabilitation.
Not only have you helped to inject hope into those environments, but you've definitely helped inject hope into people that are listening, because I feel like you epitomize everything that Comeback Stories is. And that's having the opportunity to rewrite your story and starting from wherever it is that you are, no matter how low it may be. There is an opportunity for you not only to get your life back, but to be in the makings of giving somebody else theirs back too, man. So I just want to say thank you. Yeah. And it's been an honor.
Thank you, brother. And that's what it is. Like what you guys have done, you guys have made recovery cool. We got to make recovery cool again.
Facts.
You know what I mean? Not that it ever wasn't, but when you guys get out there and lead with your stories and show what's possible, because man, I mean, think about it. When you guys were back in your addictions, it was unfathomable for me to think about getting sober. It was just an impossibility for me to marinate on. But then if I see you out there getting after it, then I got some hope. And then I have a couple of people I can emulate and seek to, seek to take a page out of your books. What a crazy ride it's been, man. I'm extremely proud of you guys and very, very proud to be on the show with you guys.
Yeah, Zach, man, it's been an honor. I mean, I hear about your story and there's so many facets of coming back, like your own comeback story and the dogs and the prisoners. And it's like, it's just really calling me to step up my game when it comes to service. I know I talk about it and have my own ways of being of service, but it's like, man, I ain't doing shit compared to this guy. So thank you. Thank you for inspiring me and showing up and sharing your story, man. I know a lot of people are going to be inspired by your story. So, where can people find you? Where can they track you down? Where can they donate?
In terms of following the program, you guys can find all about our organization at marleysmutts.org. You can find us on social media at marleysmutts, at Positive Change Program. That's PAWSITIVE. And you can find me at Zach Scow, ZACHSKOW. And marleysmutts.org is the main place for all of our information and to donate and to get involved.
Yeah, your Instagram is, it's one of the accounts that I enjoy following the most, not just because I know you personally, just because of the content and what you're putting out there. So, man, thank you again. We might have to go back for round two. This went pretty deep. And it's been an honor to chop it up with you, my man.
Yeah, you too, brother. And a big shout out, as we touched on, to my dad for helping me be here and for having NB the integral variable to my comeback story. And here's to dads who don't give up on their kids.
You know? All right, everybody, we're out.
Comeback Stories is a production of Inflection Network and iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.